agreed to this?" I roared. She nodded. I turned away, shaking my head. "This is extortion! It is negotiation, Your Majesty. A practice as old as the realm, and one your father was well versed in. Now, the sooner you sign the documents, the sooner the betrothal can be announced, and I can execute your orders." I glared at him. Execute was an appropriate word choice. I turned and walked out of the room, because all I could see was his neck squeezed between my bare hands. I had never felt like I needed Sven's tempered counsel more than I did now.
Chapter 49, Pauline.
I was on my way back to the inn, night closing in and blind to my path because Mikhail's relieved smile continued to loom in my vision. His question, "Who's the father?" clanged in my head like a cowbell, overpowering my thoughts. But then I sensed something. I felt a presence as strongly as a hand on my arm, and I looked up. She was a small figure, perched high on the portico balcony overlooking the plaza. The royal red satin trim of her cloak shone in the fading light. The queen! I stopped as a few others had, most hurrying home to their own eventide remembrances, shocked to a standstill by the sight of the queen sitting on a balcony wall. Outside of official ceremonies, I couldn't remember ever having seen her say remembrances publicly, especially not perched so precariously on a balustrade. But now her voice carried eerily over our heads, swirling like the air itself and slipping inside us just as easily. She quickly drew more onlookers, and a stillness fell over the plaza. At times it seemed her words were more sobbed than sung, more felt than said, and they scuttled through me with their haphazard delivery, some phrases skipped and others repeated. Maybe the rushed anguish was what held us all in a breathless grip. Nothing was by rote, only by her need. Every word was raw and true, and I heard it in a new way. Her face was hidden in the shadows of her hood, but I saw her reach up, wiping at what I was sure were tears. And then she said remembrances I had never heard before.
"Gather close, my brothers and sisters. Hear the words of the mother of your land. Hear the words of Morrigan and her kin. Once upon a time, long, long ago, 7 stars were flung from the sky, one to shake the mountains, one to churn the seas, one to choke the air, and 4 to test the hearts of men. Your hearts are to be tested now. Open them to the truths, for we must not just be ready for the enemy without, but also the enemy within."
She paused, choking on her words. Silence clutched the plaza, everyone waiting, mesmerized. And then she continued.
"For the dragon of many faces dwells not just past the great divide, but among you. Guard your hearts against his cunning, your children against his thirst, for his greed knows no bounds, and so shall it be. Sisters of my heart, brothers of my soul, family of my flesh, forevermore."
She kissed 2 fingers and lifted them to the heavens, a heavy sadness to her movement.
"Forevermore,"
the crowd echoed back, but I was still trying to comprehend it all. The words of Morrigan and her kin. 7 stars. A dragon? The queen stood and looked behind her as if she had heard something. She jumped down from the wall and hurried away, disappearing into the darkness as easily as night. Seconds later, the balcony doors burst open, and the watch captain stepped out on the empty balcony with several guards. It was then that I saw the chancellor standing only a few feet to my right. He was still staring up at the balcony, perhaps trying to understand the Queen's unexpected appearance. I turned, tugging on my hood, and hurried away. But in spite of the danger, something compelled me to return the next night. The Queen's urgent prayer still stirred within me. Again she spoke just as the veil of darkness fell, and this time from the East Tower. The next evening, Bertie and Gwyneth came with me. The Queen was on a wall below the western turret. I worried for her, perched so uncertainly on ledges and roofs, and I wondered if her grief had made her reckless or mad. She said things I had never heard before. The crowds grew, but it was her haunting words that prodded us to return. On the fourth night, the Queen appeared in the Abbey bell tower. "Open your hearts to the truth."
"Are you certain that's the Queen?"
Gwyneth asked. A nagging doubt that had prowled behind my breastbone was set free by her question. "She's impossible to see from here," I answered, still trying to puzzle it out. "But she does wear the royal cloak."
"What about her voice?"
And that was the strange part. Yes, her voice was like the Queen, but it was also a voice that seemed like 100 I had known. A timeless sound, like the wind in the trees. It passed through me as if it held a truth of its own. Gwyneth shook her head.
"That's not the Queen up there."
Then Bertie voiced the impossible, what we were all thinking.
"It's Leah."
I knew it was true.
"Thank the gods she is alive. But why is she posing as the Queen?"
Gwyneth wondered aloud.
"Because the Queen is revered," Bertie answered. "Who would listen to the most wanted criminal in Morrigan?"
"And she is preparing us," I said. But preparing us for what? I didn't know.
Chapter 50.
Only a midnight moon gave contour to the room. Dim gray defined the lines of the ornate pewter goblet in my hand. I set it back in the curio cabinet, alongside other mementos from years of service. A medallion from Icelandia, a gilded seashell from Gitos, a sculpted jade bear from Gastineau. Unique tokens from every kingdom on the continent. Except, of course, Venda, with whom there were no diplomatic relations. The vice-regent's duties as consul took him on many long trips. I hadn't seen him complain, but the pleasure he expressed upon returning home had said much about the hardships of his travel. I closed the door of the cabinet and sat in a chair in the corner, waiting. The darkness offered quiet comfort. I could almost forget where I was, except for the sword lying across my lap. I was running out of options. It was getting harder to sneak through the citadel, and by the fourth evening, I'd had to switch to the abbey. The citizens found me there. No doubt the cabinet would have guards stationed at the abbey tonight, too. The first night I had said remembrances over the portico, it was a miracle that I had gotten away at all. I was more careful now, but that night I was reckless and undone. My stomach had twisted into knots. All my carefully planned words had vanished. After seeing my mother with the royal scholar, grief had slashed through me like a sharp knife, shredding everything I had hoped for. A tearful reunion, a long-earned explanation, a misunderstanding. Something. Instead, I found the royal scholar standing at my mother's side, and got an admission of conspiracy, and a guard drawing his sword. 30 mad seconds with her became a betrayal of the worst kind, and the most painful and perplexing thing of all was, I still ached for her. I heard footsteps in the outer chamber. I adjusted my grip on the sword. I had nothing to lose by this meeting, and maybe something to gain, however small. I'd already searched the Chancellor's and Royal Scholar's offices, hoping to turn up some sort of evidence. A letter. Anything. The rooms were suspiciously clean and orderly, as if they'd already been scoured and emptied of anything incriminating. I even searched the ashes of their hearths, knowing that was how they'd tried to make things disappear in the past, and found small bits of charred paper, but nothing more. The vice-regent's office was cluttered, his desk a busy sea of papers clamoring for his attention, a half-finished letter to the trade minister, and some commendations ready for his signature and seal. Nothing had been scoured here. The footsteps drew closer, and the office door opened, a triangle of yellow briefly illuminating the floor before it was shut out again. He crossed the room, his footfalls light, and a faint scent swept in with him. Cologne? I had forgotten about the perfumed and pampered smells of court. In Venda, the council mostly smelled of sweat and sour ale. I heard the soft whoosh of the thickly upholstered chair as he sat, and then he lit a candle. He still didn't see me. "Hello, Lord Vice-Regent." He startled and began to stand. "No," I said softly but firmly. "Don't." I stepped into the light so he could see my sword casually resting over my shoulder. He eyed the weapon and returned to his seat, saying simply, "Arabella." His expression was solemn, but his voice was low and even, unpanicked, as I'd thought it would be. The timekeeper would have been spinning in circles and screaming by now, but the vice-regent wasn't prone to hysterics like some in the cabinet. He was never in a hurry, never rushed. I sat down in the chair across from him.
"Are you going to point that thing at me the whole time?" he asked.
"It's not pointed. Believe me, if it were, you would know it and feel it. I'm actually affording you a bit of grace. I always liked you more than the other members of the cabinet, but that doesn't mean you're not one of them."
"One of what, Arabella?"
I tried to gauge the innocence of his response. At this moment, it didn't matter if he had ever been kind to me. I hated that I couldn't take a chance even on kindness. I could trust no one. "Are you a traitor, Vice-Regent?" I asked him. "Like the Chancellor and Royal Scholar?"
"I'm not sure what you're saying."
"Treason, Lord Vice-Regent. Treason at the highest levels. I think the Chancellor has grown tired of the baubles on his fingers. And who knows what the Royal Scholar's stake in this is. One thing I've learned from our dear Commissar is it all comes down to power and an insatiable hunger for it." I told him about the Morrigese scholars in Venda, helping the Commissar arm and build a massive army. As I explained, I carefully watched his eyes, his face, his hands. All I saw was surprise and disbelief, and possibly a certain level of fear, as if I were insane. When I was finished, he sat back in his chair, his head shaking slightly, still absorbing everything I had said. "A barbarian army? Scholars in Venda? Those are rather fantastical claims, Arabella. I don't know what to do with them. I can't go to the cabinet armed only with accusations against esteemed members, especially from, I'm sorry to say, you. I'd be laughed out of the hall. Do you have any evidence?" I didn't want to admit that I had none. I thought of Caden, who had actually seen the army, the scholars in the caverns, and intimately knew of the Commissar's plans. But the word of a Venden assassin would be as laughable as mine. "I may," I answered. "And then I'll expose the dragon of many faces." He looked at me, confusion wrinkling his brow.
"A dragon? Now what are you talking about?"
He wasn't familiar with the phrase, or at least he pretended not to be. I shook his question away and stood.
"Don't get up. And that's not a polite request." "What do you want from me, Arabella?"
I looked at him, scrutinizing every angle of his face, every flutter of his lashes. I want you to know there are traitors in your midst, and if you are one of them, you will pay. You'll pay as dearly as my brother did. I wasn't the one who killed him. It was those fools who conspire with the Khomezar. He frowned. The conspiring fools again. If they exist, as you claim, they've managed to hide it from me, so maybe they're not as foolish as you think. Trust me, I said. They're not half as cunning as the Khomezar, nor half as intelligent. They're fools to believe he'd keep any agreement they've struck with him. The Khomezar shares nothing, least of all power. Whatever he has promised, and I'm guessing it's the throne of Morrigan, they will never see it. Once he uses them for his purposes, they're done. As are we. I turned to leave, but he quickly leaned forward, the candlelight illuminating a stray blonde wisp falling over his brow. His eyes were earnest.
Wait. Please, Arabella. Stay. Let me help. I'm sorry I didn't more vigorously defend you. I've made mistakes in the past, too. Ones I deeply regret.
He stood.
I'm sure we can straighten this out if...
No, I said, raising my sword. The scent wafted again, a flutter so faint it was hardly there, but it unsettled me in a deep, distant way. It was jasmine. The thought burrowed deeper. Jasmine. In the same breath, I saw a little boy clinging to the trousers of his father, pleading to stay. Jasmine soap. I was jolted with the impossible. I gaped at the vice-regent, staring as if I were meeting him for the first time. His white blonde hair, his calm brown eyes, the smooth tremor of his voice floating through my head, and then another voice of a similar timbre. I was a bastard child born to a high-born lord. My breath froze in my lungs. How had I never seen it before? Heard it before? The vice-regent was Caden's father, a man as cruel as the Khomezar, beating his son and selling him to strangers for a copper. He stared at me, waiting, hopeful. But was he a traitor? I've made mistakes in the past, too, ones I deeply regret. Worry flashed through his eyes. Worry over me? Or worry that I had discovered his secret? Why would I ever trust a man who threw out his 8-year-old son like a piece of garbage? His eyes widened.
Caden? Caden's alive?
Yes, alive, and still very scarred. He has never healed from your betrayal. His face crumpled as if he was overwhelmed, and he leaned forward, his head braced in his hands. He mumbled quietly to himself, then said,
I searched for him for years. I knew I'd made a mistake the minute it was done, but I couldn't find him. I assumed he was dead.
Searched for him, after selling him for a copper to strangers. He looked up, his eyes wet.
I did no such thing. Is that what he told you?
He leaned back in his chair, looking weak and spent.
I shouldn't be surprised. He was a grieving child who had just lost his mother. I've wanted to take back that decision 100 times, but I was grieving too.
And what decision was that? His eyes squeezed shut as if a painful memory tormented him.
I was trapped in a loveless marriage. I didn't mean for the affair with Catherine to happen, but it did. My wife tolerated the arrangement well enough because she had no use for me, and Catherine was good to our sons. But after Catherine died, she'd have no part of Caden. When I tried to move him into our house, she beat him in a rage. I didn't know what else to do. For his own good, I contacted Catherine's only relative, a distant uncle who agreed to take him in. I was the one who gave him money for Caden's care. When I went to visit Caden, the uncle and his family were gone. That's a far different story than the one Caden tells. What else can you expect, Arabella? He was only 8 years old. In only a few days, his world was turned upside down. His mother died, and his father sent him to live with strangers. Where is he? Here. Even if I had known where Caden was, I wouldn't have revealed it to the Vice-Regent. Yet. Last I saw him, he was in Venda, an accomplice of the Komazar. Disbelief shone in his eyes, and I left before he could ask me another question.
Chapter 51.
I paced the caretaker's cottage on the edge of the mill pond, listening to the rain. I had already stoked a fire and wiped down the sparse furniture that filled it. A battered table, three rickety chairs, a stool, a rocker that was missing one arm, and the wooden frame of a bed, still sturdy, but its mattress eaten by mice long ago. The cottage and the mill that sat across from it on the other side of the pond were abandoned decades ago for a deeper, larger pond farther east of Civica. Only bullfrogs, dragonflies, and raccoons visited here now, and occasionally young princes and a princess fleeing the scrutiny of court. Our names were carved in the wide doorframe, along with those of dozens of other village children, at least those brave enough to venture here. It was said to be haunted by the ancients. Bryn and I may have had something to do with that rumor. I suppose we wanted it all to ourselves. Even my father's name was carved here. Branson. I ran my fingers over the rough letters. It was hard to imagine that he'd ever been a carefree child running through the woods, and I wondered at the way we all change, all the outside forces that press and mold and push us into people and things we hadn't planned to be. Maybe it happened so gradually that by the time we noticed, it was too late to be anything else. Like the Komazar, Reginaeus, a boy and name snuffed out of existence. I fingered my name in the wood, the lines crooked but deep. Leah. I took my knife out and squeezed in four more letters in front of it. Jezza. And I wondered at who I had become, someone I had never planned to be. Pauline's name wasn't carved in the wood, and as far as I knew, she had never been here. By the time she arrived in Civica, the cottage had lost some of its magic for me and my brothers, and we rarely came any more. Besides, such wanderings were off-limits, and Pauline followed the protocol of the Queen's Court to the letter. Well, almost to the letter, until she met Mikhail. Where was she? Had Natia misunderstood, or spoken to the wrong person? Maybe the rain had delayed her? But it was only a light rain, and we were used to that in Civica. Today, when I returned to my room, my mind had still been reeling with my late-night revelation. The Vice-Regent had seemed our best possibility of someone to trust in the cabinet. I had tried to test for his truthfulness, and everything he had said seemed genuine. Even his claim about deep regrets. Was it possible he had changed in the 11 years since he threw Caden out? 11 years was a long time. I had changed in far less. So had Caden. The Vice-Regent was already in a high position of power, second in command to my father. What more would he have to gain? I was so occupied with these thoughts that Natia had to grab my arms and shake them, then repeat her news. She claimed she'd found Pauline. She said Pauline's head was bowed and covered so she couldn't see her hair, but she knew a pregnant belly when she saw one, and Natia had chased after her just outside the cemetery gate. When she was close enough, Natia called her name. Pauline seemed fearful, but she agreed to come. I prayed she wasn't afraid of me. Surely she couldn't believe the lies. Or maybe she was only being cautious. She didn't know Natia, and perhaps she suspected a trap. But she knew the mill pond had once been a favorite haunt of mine. A stranger wouldn't have suggested it. Maybe Birdie and Gwyneth had delayed her. Gwyneth was suspicious of everything, and here in Civica, rightly so. I should take that as a good sign. But still, my anxiety grew. I paced the cottage, and finally pulled out a chair and sat, staring at the cottage door, my hands kneading my thighs. Bit by bit, I was losing everything. If I lost Pauline, too, I wasn't sure what I would do. What if she... The handle rattled, and the door eased open cautiously, its creak the only sound. As a quick afterthought, I put my hand on my dagger. But then Pauline stepped in, her hair dripping in wet strands, her flushed cheeks shimmering with rain. Our gazes met, and her eyes told me what I had feared. She knew. There was a condemning sharpness in them I had never seen before. My stomach floated, even as my heart sank. "You should have told me, Leah," she said. "You should have told me. I could have dealt with it. You didn't even give me a chance." I nodded, words stuck in my throat. She was right. I was afraid, Pauline. I thought I could bury the truth and make it go away. I was wrong. She stepped toward me, hesitant at first, then earnest, throwing her arms around me, a fierceness in her grip. Angry. Her fists curling into my clothes, demanding, shaking, and then she leaned into me, sobbing. "You're alive," she cried into my shoulder. "You're alive." My chest shook, and I cried with her, the months and lies between us vanishing. She told me how frightened she'd been, the agony of waiting with no word, and the relief she felt when she saw me impersonating the Queen. She, Birdie, and Gwyneth had been discreetly looking for me since then. "I love you, Leah. You are my sister, by the gods, a sister as true as blood. I knew what they said about you were lies." I wasn't sure who held up whom, each of us heavy in the other's arms, our cheeks wet against each other. "My brothers? Bryn and Regan are well, but worried about you." Now it was my fists that curled into her clothes, and I choked back tears as she told me they hadn't stopped believing in me either. They had asked a lot of questions trying to get at the truth, and promised that as soon as they returned, they would find it. She said Birdie and Gwyneth were here with her, and she told me where they were staying. I understood now why Natia hadn't been able to find them. It was a small tavern down an alley that let rooms above the shop. I remembered it. There was no sign. You had to know it was there. No doubt Gwyneth had found that one. I finally stepped back and wiped my cheeks, surveying her girth. "And you're well?" She nodded, rubbing her hand over her belly. "I spotted Mikhail weeks ago, but I only had the courage to confront him recently." A bittersweet smile creased her eyes, and we sat down at the table. She talked about him, recalling her dreams for their future that she thought had been his dreams, too, all the times they held hands and talked and planned and kissed. She went over memories and details as if they were flower petals she was plucking one at a time and then letting them go in the wind. I listened, feeling a part of me break. "He'll never be this child's father," she finally said. She told me with calm resignation about the girls on his arm, his denial, and all the doubts she'd carefully tucked away that came to life before her eyes when they spoke. "I knew what he was like when I met him. I thought I was that one girl special enough to change him. I was a happy fool living in a fantasy. I'm not that girl anymore." I saw the change in her. She was different. Sober. The dreams she'd had were swept from her eyes. I saw all the reasons I had lied to her, thinking if her fantasy stayed alive, maybe mine could, too. You were never a fool, Pauline. Your dreams gave flight to my own. She pressed her hand to her back as if trying to counter the weight of the baby pulling against her spine. I have different aspirations now. We all do, I answered, feeling the tug of lost dreams. She frowned. You mean Rafe? I nodded. He showed up at Birdie's Inn looking for you. When I told him about Caden, he started giving orders, saying more men would come to help. And they did, but none of them ever returned. At first I feared something had happened to them, but then I wondered if he had deceived us just like Caden. Birdie guessed that Rafe wasn't really a farmer, which only fueled my worries that he couldn't be trusted. Birdie was right. Rafe wasn't a farmer, I said. He was a soldier, and also Prince Jackson of Dalbrek, the betrothed I left at the altar. She looked at me like I had lost my mind back in Venda. But he's no longer a prince, I added. Now he's the King of Dalbrek. Prince? King? None of this makes sense. I know, I said. It doesn't. Let me start at the beginning. I tried to tell her everything in the order that it had happened, but very quickly she interrupted. Caden put a hood over your head, then dragged you across the entire Camlan Tow? I saw the hatred in her eyes that Caden had feared she would harbor. Yes, he did, but I don't understand how he could share a holy feast with us at Birdie's table in one moment and threaten to kill us both in the next. How could he? We both froze. We heard the whicker of a horse. I put my finger to my lips. Did you ride here? I whispered. She shook her head. Neither did I. It was a short walk, and it was easier to slip through the woods unseen on foot. Could someone have followed you? Her eyes widened, and I was shocked to see her draw a knife. She had never carried one before. I drew mine as well. Heavy footsteps scraped on the stone steps outside the door. Pauline and I both stood, and then the door opened.
Chapter 52. Caden.
I saw the blade before I saw her. It flashed past me, slicing my shoulder just as I slammed her up against the wall. And then I saw that it was Pauline. Leah was yelling at both of us. Drop the knife, Pauline! Drop it! Caden, let her go! The knife was still firm in her grip, her hand straining against mine. Stop! I yelled. She seethed. Not this time, barbarian! I felt the sting where the blade had cut me and the warmth of blood spreading across my shoulder. What's the matter with you? You could have killed me! Her eyes held no apology, only hatred that I didn't think it was possible for Pauline to possess. Stop! Leah said firmly, and she pulled the knife from Pauline's hand. She nodded for me to let Pauline go. I took a chance and released her, moving out of her reach, waiting for her to come at me again. Leah stepped between us. I told him to come, Pauline, she said. He's here to help. We can trust him. But Pauline was incensed and still not listening. You lied to us! We treated you with nothing but kindness, and then... Leah continued to try to explain and calm Pauline down. I stood there, not knowing what to say, because every word she flung at me was true. True as Pauline always was. I had traded on her kindness and trust. He's changed, Pauline. You have to stop and listen to me. She stared at me, her eyes like glass, her chest heaving. and then suddenly she doubled over, clutching her stomach. Leah grabbed Pauline's arm to steady her. Water seeped to the floor around her feet. Pauline groaned and then was clutched with a stronger spasm. I ran to her other side, and Leah and I both kept her from falling. Even in her pain, she tried to wrench free of me. "The bed!" Leah yelled. I scooped Pauline into my arms and carried her to the bare wood frame in the corner. "Get the bedroll from my horse!" Leah ran out the door, and Pauline ordered me to put her down. "I will," I said. "Believe me, nothing will give me greater pleasure as soon as Leah returns." Leah was back in seconds, shaking out the roll, and I laid Pauline on top of it. "It can't be time," Leah said to Pauline. "You still have a month to go." Pauline shook her head. "It's time." Leah stared at Pauline's swollen belly, not trying to hide her alarm. "I don't know anything about this. I've never..." Her gaze shot to me. "Do you?" "No," I said, shaking my head. "Not me. I've never done it either. I've seen horses..."
"I am not a horse!"
Pauline screamed. She leaned forward in another spasm.
"Birdie!" she groaned. "Go get Birdie!"
I started for the door. "Tell me where..." "No," Leah said, cutting me off. "Birdie would never come with you, and I can find her faster. Stay here." Pauline and I both protested.
"There's no other choice," Leah snapped. "Stay, keep her comfortable. I'll be right back."
She left, slamming the door behind her. I stared at the door, not wanting to turn and face Pauline. Babies took hours, I told myself, sometimes days. It wasn't more than a 20-minute walk into town. Leah would be back within the hour. I listened to the rain, coming down louder and harder. Pauline moaned again, and I reluctantly turned. "Do you need something?"
"Not from you!"
An hour passed, and I alternated between silently cursing Leah and worrying about what had happened to her. Where was she? Pauline's pains were becoming stronger and more frequent. She swatted my hand away when I tried to wipe her brow with a cool cloth. Between pains, she leveled a scrutinizing stare at me.
"Last time I saw you, Leah was ordering you to go straight to hell. What dark magic did you weave to make her trust you now?"
I looked at her glistening face, damp strands of her blonde hair clinging to her cheek, a loss in her eyes I had never seen before. "People change, Pauline." Her lip pulled up in disgust, and she looked away.
"No, they don't."
Her voice wobbled, full of unexpected sorrow instead of anger. "You've changed," I said. She glared at me, her hands passing over her belly.
"Is that supposed to be a joke?"
"I meant in other ways, most notably the knife you were flashing in my face." Her eyes narrowed.
"Betrayal tends to familiarize one with weapons."
I nodded. "Yes," I thought. "Sadly, it does."
"It looks like someone's taken a weapon to your head, too," she said.
I reached behind, feeling the crusted gash on my scalp. "It would seem so," I answered. I had passed out and slept for 2 straight days on the trail after vomiting up half my insides. The throbbing had eased, but it was probably what had dimmed my judgment enough to walk into an unknown cottage without my own weapon drawn. Perhaps that was a good thing, or Pauline might be lying dead on the floor now. I walked over to the window and opened the shutter, hoping to see a glimpse of Leah and Birdie. The downpour obscured the forest beyond, and thunder rumbled overhead. I gently pressed on the back of my head, wondering how bad the gash was. Beneath the crusted patch of blood, there was still a sizable lump. It was ironic that a housekeeper armed only with an iron pot had nearly done in the assassin of Venda. How the Ratan would laugh at that. The name dug into me with a surprising sting and longing. Ratan. It brought back the familiar, the feeling of pride, the one place in my entire life where I had felt like I belonged. Now I was in a kingdom that didn't want me, and in a cottage where I wasn't welcome. I didn't want to be here either, but I couldn't leave. I wondered about Grizz and Eben. Surely Grizz was healed, and they were on their way by now. They were the closest thing I had to family, a family of poisonous vipers. The thought made me grin. "What's so amusing?" Pauline asked. I looked at the severity in her gaze. Had I done this to her? I remembered all of her kindnesses back in Terravin, her gentleness. I had thought that the young man she so earnestly waited for couldn't possibly deserve her, and then when I learned he had died, I had hoped it wasn't by a Vendan hand. Maybe that was what she saw when she looked at me, a Vendan just like the one who had killed her baby's father. Though my smile had long faded, her gaze remained fixed on me, waiting. "Nothing's amusing," I answered, and looked away. Another hour slipped by, and it seemed one labor pain hadn't subsided before another began. I dipped the rag into the bucket of cool water and wiped her brow. She didn't resist this time, but closed her eyes as if trying to pretend it wasn't me. I was getting a bad feeling about this. She was racked with another spasm. When the pain finally passed and she relaxed again against the makeshift pillow I had made for her, I said, "We may have to do this alone, Pauline." Her eyes shot open. "You deliver my baby?" A smile broke her face for the first time, and she laughed. "I promise you, the first hands that touch my little girl won't be a barbarian's." I ignored her barb. It didn't hold the same venom as an hour ago. She was getting tired of fighting me. "You're so sure it's a girl?" She didn't get a chance to answer. She was seized with a pain so strong I was afraid she wasn't going to breathe again, and then on its heels came a sobbing scream. "No," she said, shaking her head. "No, I think she's coming. Blessed gods, not now." The next moments were hot and blurred, her anguished wails tearing through me. She cried. She begged. I held her shoulders, and she bent forward in pain. Her nails dug into my arm. My heart pounded furiously with every scream. It was coming. There was no more waiting. "Damn it, Leah." I eased Pauline back against the pillow, lifted up her dress, then pulled her underclothes free before I could think too much about what I was doing. A head crested between her legs. She said 100 things to me between each pain, a breathless one-way conversation of pleas to the gods and curses. She fell back crying, too tired to push. "I can't," she sobbed. "We're almost there, Pauline. Push, I see its head. It's coming, just a little more." She cried, a weak happiness briefly washing over her face before it vanished and she screamed again. I cupped the head, more of it emerging. "One more push," I yelled. "One more." And then the shoulders came, and with a last quick whoosh, it was in my hands, wet and warm, its tiny body arching, a small hand waving past its face. A whole baby in my hands, slivers of eyes already peering out at the world, peering at me. A gaze so deep, it carved a hole in my chest. "Is it all right?" Pauline asked weakly. The baby cried, answering her question. "He's perfect,"
I said. You have a beautiful son, Pauline. And I laid him in her arms.
Chapter 53.
It was almost like a full tavern, so many crowded into one place. I tried to imagine it as Terravin, except there was no ale, no stew, no laughter. But there was a baby. A beautiful, perfect baby. Bertie sat on the end of the bed, crooning over him as Pauline slept. Gwyneth, Natia, and I sat at the table, and Caden lay sleeping on the floor in front of the fire. He was shirtless, his shoulder freshly bandaged, and his head rested on a folded blanket that Natia had brought. The rain poured down relentlessly. We were lucky the roof held. A bucket caught a single leak in the corner. When I had tracked down the room Pauline had directed me to in the village, I'd found it empty and ransacked, with the windows flung open in spite of the rain. They fled, I thought, through a window. That was a very bad sign. The innkeeper claimed he'd seen nothing and didn't know where they'd gone, but I heard the terror in his voice, and then I saw the fearful curiosity as he peered into the shadows of my hood. In my haste, I had left the mourning scarf behind. I pulled the hood farther down over my face and ran to the abbey grounds. I instructed Natia to go to the cottage with our horses and supplies while I hunted down Bertie and Gwyneth. I searched the streets and peered through tavern windows, hoping to catch a glimpse of them somewhere. But then the innkeeper's terror registered with me again. He had been as afraid of me as of whoever had ransacked the room, and was eager for me to leave. I ran back to the inn. Bertie and Gwyneth would never have left without Pauline. I found them hiding in the kitchen. It was a tearful but hasty reunion. Gwyneth said she'd seen the Chancellor and soldiers outside her window and heard their brisk demands to the innkeeper to be led to Pauline's room. They were baffled at how the Chancellor had known Pauline was there. They confirmed the innkeeper was trustworthy, and he had stalled as long as he could, giving her and Bertie a chance to flee. When I told them of Pauline's condition, the innkeeper sent us on our way with food and supplies that we packed onto Nove and Dieci. Natia had been able to find the cottage, but said Caden had already delivered the baby by the time she got there, and had wrapped him in his shirt. She had bandaged the cut on his shoulder, which I knew was inflicted by Pauline, but she had also tended a gash on the back of his head. He'd told Natia he had received a heavy blow from an iron pot. From whom? I wondered. That was why he hadn't shown at our rendezvous point, and perhaps explained his heavy sleep now. He never stirred when we walked into the cottage. I watched his even breaths. It was strange, but I wasn't sure I'd ever seen him sleep before. Whenever I was awake, he was awake. Even that one rainy night months ago when we'd slept in a ruin and his eyes were closed, I'd known a part of him still watched me. Not tonight. This was a deep sleep that worried me. It made him seem more vulnerable. I hadn't even had a moment to express relief when he had walked into the cottage this morning, but now I stared at him, emotion welling in me. I kissed two fingers and lifted them to the gods. Thank you. He was injured, but he was alive. I think I still have a few leaves of Thanis in my pack, Natia. Will you steep them and make a poultice for his head?
Thanis? Bertie asked.
A foul-tasting weed that has some helpful uses beyond drinking. It grows only in Venda. Good for heart, soul, and growling stomachs when food is scarce, except when it seeds and turns from purple to gold. Then it becomes poison. It's the one thing they have in abundance in Venda. The mere mention of the weed made an unexpected yearning swell in me. Memories that I had buried tumbled loose. I thought of all the proffered cups of Thanis, the humble gifts of a humble people. Gwyneth angled her head at Caden sleeping by the fire and frowned. So how did all, she twirled her hand in the air, this come about? How does one go from being an assassin to being your accomplice? I'm not sure accomplice is the right word, I said, snapping beans and adding them to a kettle. It's a long story. After we eat. I looked over my shoulder at Birdie. Which reminds me, I promised Enzo I'd tell you he hasn't burned down the inn yet. Boarders are fed, and the dishes are clean. Birdie's brows shot up. Stew? I nodded. Yes, even stew. And not half bad. Gwyneth rolled her eyes with genuine surprise. The gods still perform miracles. No one was more surprised than I was when I saw him in the kitchen wearing an apron and cleaning a fish, I said. Birdie huffed, her face beaming with pride. Knock me dead. I told him he had to step up. Could have gone either way, but I had no choice. I had to take the chance and trust him. What about that farmer? Gwyneth asked. What became of him? He never returned to the inn as promised. Is he dead? That farmer. I heard the suspicion in how she described him. Birdie and Natia both eyed me, waiting for my answer. I hardened my expression, adding a slab of salted pork to the kettle before I put the lid on and hung it over the fire. I sat back down at the table. He returned to his own kingdom. He's fine, I assume. I hoped. I thought about the general who was challenging him back in Dalbrek. I couldn't imagine Rafe not prevailing, but I remembered the gravity of his expression, the lines that etched near his eyes every time one of the officers brought it up. There were no guarantees in such things.
Dalbrek, that's where he's from, Natia interjected. And he's no farmer. He's a king. He ordered Leah to—
Natia, I sighed. Please, I'll explain. And I did, as best I could. I skimmed over details, emphasizing the major events in Venda and what I had learned there. There were some details I couldn't relive again, but it was hard to skim past Aster. She was still a deep bruise inside me, purple and swollen and painful to the touch. I had to stop and recompose my thoughts when I came to her role in this. Many people died that last day, I said simply, except the one person who deserved to. When I was finished, Gwyneth leaned back in her chair and shook her head. Jezalia, she said, musing about the Song of Venda. I knew that claw and vine was there to stay. No kitchen brush was going to scrub it from your back. Birdie cleared her throat.
Kitchen brush?
Gwyneth stood as if the ramifications had finally sunk in.
Sweet mercy, are we ever thick in it now? She said, circling the room.
The first time I laid eyes on you, Princess, I knew you were going to be trouble. I shook my head apologetically.
I'm sorry.
She stepped close and squeezed my shoulder. Hold on. I didn't say it wasn't the kind of trouble I like. My throat swelled. Birdie stood, the baby still cradled in one arm, and walked over and kissed the top of my head.
Blazing balls. We'll figure this out. Somehow.
I leaned against Birdie's side and closed my eyes. Everything inside me felt like a rush of tears, sick and feverish. But on the outside, I was dry and numb.
All right, enough of that, Gwyneth said, and sat down opposite me.
Birdie took the remaining chair. This is a whole different game now. The eyes of the realm seem to have set their sights on more than order. What's your plan?
You're assuming I have one.
She frowned.
You do.
I had never voiced it out loud. It was dangerous, but it was the only way I could ensure that my voice would be heard by the whole court and those who were still loyal to Morrigan, if only for a few minutes. Something I've done before, but not successfully. A coup d'etat, I said. I explained that I had led a rebellion with my brothers and their friends into Aldred Hall when I was 14. It hadn't gone well. But I was armed only with righteous indignation and demands. This time I intend to go in with 2 platoons of soldiers and evidence. Bertie choked on her tea.
Armed soldiers?
My brothers, I answered. I know when they return that they and their platoons will back me.
2 platoons against the whole Moragee's army?
Bertie questioned.
The citadel would be surrounded in minutes.
Which is why I need evidence. The hall is defensible for a short time with the cabinet as hostage. All I need is a few minutes, if I can expose at least one of the traitors with evidence. Then the conclave might listen to everything I have to say.
Gwyneth snorted. Or you'd get an arrow in your chest before you got a chance to say anything at all.
It was well known that during conclave sessions, guards in full regalia, armed with bows and arrows, were posted in 2 gallery towers that overlooked Aldred Hall. An arrow had never been shot by them. It was ceremonial, another tradition held over from earlier times, when lords from across Morrigan convened. But the guards' arrows were real, and I presumed they knew how to shoot them. The last time I had stormed in, I'd known they wouldn't shoot the king's daughter. This time, I didn't have that assurance.
Yes, it's possible I could get shot, I agreed. I can't figure everything out at once. Right now, I just need to find evidence. I know the Chancellor and Royal Scholar are involved, but when I searched their offices, I turned up nothing. They're so clean, not even a dust mote dared to hang in the air. There is also... I stopped.
My mother. These 2 small words I couldn't force loose. No, not her. They were a wall inside me, unscalable even after what I had seen. I couldn't say her name in the same breath as the other traitors. She would never have put Walther at risk. She loved him too much for that. Some things were true and real. They had to be. I closed my eyes, seeing the sky full of stars and the rooftop she'd led me away from. There's nothing to know, sweet child. It's only the chill of the night. I had seen her with the Royal Scholar myself, and I knew he was mired in this. His favored scholars worked in the Sanctum Caverns. Bertie and Gwyneth reached across the table and squeezed my hands, and I opened my eyes.
Hey, can I get in on some of that?
I looked up. Pauline was awake. I went to her bedside and sat on the edge, and we all took turns kissing and congratulating her before Bertie nestled the baby into her arms. Gwyneth helped Pauline get the baby latched and feeding at her breast, then stood back proudly with her hands on her hips.
Look at that. He takes to it like a champion.
Have a name for him yet?
Bertie asked. A brief cloud passed through Pauline's eyes.
No.
Plenty of time for that later, Bertie said. I'll see if we have something better than that old torn shirt to wrap him in.
Maybe one of those 2-headed sweaters you knitted?
Gwyneth winked, and she and Bertie went to the opposite corner and began unpacking the bag they had brought. I reached out and touched a tiny pink toe that peeked from Caden's swaddling shirt.
He's beautiful, I said.
How are you feeling?
Well enough, she answered, rolling her eyes. Considering I just paraded my lady parts to a killer barbarian.
She sighed.
But I suppose, compared to what you've been through, it's a small indignity to bear.
I smiled at the baby. And look at the prize. He was worth it, no? She beamed at her son, gently running her finger over his cheek.
Yes, she said. I still can't quite believe it.
She looked over at Caden, her smile fading.
What happened to him? She whispered. His scars?
Caden lay curled on his side, his back to us. I had become used to his scars, but I was sure they had been shocking to the others. "Betrayal," I answered. And I told her about who he had been.